and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the denial by the founder of the Mercenary Army Blackwater, Eric Prince, stating he had no knowledge of a training agreement between a company he founded, Hong Kong-based Frontier Services Group, and the Chinese government to build a training center in South Xinjiang province aimed at facilitating a security clampdown on the restive Muslim minority Uyghurs. We'll be joined by Robert Young Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer who was hired by Eric Prince to write his biography. We'll examine the role Prince has been playing in China's geopolitical and economic initiative, One Belt, One Road, and how Frontier Services Group, which started out as a logistics and consultancy firm, has moved into securing rare minerals in Africa for China and privatized military security and intelligence for the Chinese government, possibly violating international law and working against U.S. interests and policies. Then we'll be joined by Alan Lichtman, an historian of American politics who teaches at American University and has studied both the American right and the presidency. We'll discuss the White House leak of Trump's daily schedule, revealing an astonishing amount of executive time, which is code for watching TV and calling his friends. We'll discuss how leaks coming from the White House paint a portrait of chaos from a president who doesn't inspire confidence in those closest to him, aside from a few sycophants like Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who manage a hyperbolic spin on the president's schedule, saying Trump is, quote, the most productive president in modern history. Then finally, ahead of the State of the Union, we'll speak with Princeton presidential historian Julian Zelizer about his article at CNN, State of the Union will kick off an epic fight between Trump and Pelosi. We'll discuss what to expect from Trump's address that was postponed due to a government shutdown over his border wall and whether he will announce he intends to declare a national emergency tonight to get his wall. Then we'll assess how effective the Democratic rebuttal might be and look into past presidents delivering their addresses in front of House speakers with whom they had contentious relations, noting Nixon's 1974 State of the Union delivered 6 months before his resignation. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Robert Young Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has had a first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Young Pelton.
Hey, Ian. Great to be here.
Well, thank you, Robert. And you know Eric Prince very well. He hired you to write a biography on him, and then he stiffed you, and you had to sue him. But he's come back into the news because of a training center that the group that he founded, Frontier Services Group, apparently have signed an agreement with the Chinese government to build a training facility in the western region of Xinjiang province where the restive Muslim ethnic minority Uyghurs are. And initially, he has, even though it appeared on a Chinese website, he has said, when was this? About a few days ago, Prince said that he had no knowledge of involvement with this preliminary memorandum signed by the Hong Kong-based company that he founded, Frontier Services Group, to build this training base in China's far western region. So what do you make of the denial and what's going on?
Well, a couple of things. FSG, or Frontier Services Group, was set up by a gentleman named Greg Smith because Eric was having a hard time raising money for a company called Frontier Resources Group, which was going to invest money in Africa. And, you know, as we know, the Chinese are very interested in Africa and logistics. So when he created FSG, it was a reverse merger, and CITIC, which is basically a sovereign wealth fund for the Communist Chinese Party, was an existing shareholder. And the original goal was to go out to Africa, buy all these mines and transportation companies, and then turn it into a big empire. and that began to falter. So what happened was they changed their strategy, and they issued a press release in 2017 saying that not only have we changed our strategy to support the One Belt, One Road initiative, we're also going to focus on security, which means they were turning away from Africa, and they were using Eric's skills in the formation of Blackwater and in other businesses. The problem with that is, of course, Eric has a deferred prosecution agreement with the federal government, which forced him to sell all his related industries and stay out of that business. And as he got closer to this new strategy, he was walking a very fine line between what the Chinese call security, which in this company he bought, it's a security company which trains anti-terrorism, you know, anti-kidnapping, but very benign stuff, and some of the more brutal tactics of the Communist Chinese Party. So if you Google 2017 in the spring, Eric was very active in U.S. and foreign media promoting this new strategy and how they were building a camp in Yunnan, which is sort of the gateway to Southeast Asia, and also surrounded by ethnic minorities and rebels, and also in what they call East Turkestan, which is even more contentious, and that's the gateway to Pakistan and Afghanistan. He was demoted in December of last year from chairman to deputy chairman, and this struck everybody kind of odd because there was this demotion, and suddenly they brought in the former chairman of CITIC to run FSG. So there's a couple of theories. One is that Eric is actually disconnected from that company. Or the second one is that he's treading water, hoping he doesn't get in trouble. So what essentially happened was an obscure page on the FSG site showed officials of CITIC signing an agreement with XPCC, which is a Chinese paramilitary organization made out of Han ethnic settlers that go into this Turkestan region and essentially force settlement, construction, agriculture. And then amongst these are these training camps. Now, Eric was going to help develop the security and logistics side of that. But the way it was spun, because this photograph was with this paramilitary group, was that this was part of the re-education camps. So that's the story in a nutshell. And then FSG started deleting emails and notices as far back as 2017.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Young-Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has had a first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. And his books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, License to Kill, Hired Guns, and The War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. But FSG, Frontier Services Group, they oversee the International Security Defense College in Beijing, which trains all kinds of people. And the school's promotional material boasts that FSG has trained more than 5,000 Chinese military personnel, 200 plainclothes police officers, 500 SWAT specialists, 200 railway police officers, and 300 overseas military police officers. So are Eric Prince's fingerprints on all of that?
Well, this is the beauty of Eric Prince, because do you remember when he left in August of 2010 and he was interviewed by myself as he was getting ready to go to Abu Dhabi? You know, he would not talk about what he was going to do over there, but he essentially left to achieve his dream, which was to set up not one mercenary army, but three, two in Somalia and one in Abu Dhabi. And he had to be very, very careful to put a lot of plywood, a lot of legal plywood between his dream project, which is to be the head of a mercenary army, and the actual illegalities of doing that as an American citizen and as someone who had clearances with the federal government. He then got into more benign things in South Sudan, but again veered into military-type operations and making his employees very, very nervous. And if you've read The Intercept, you've seen these PowerPoints that he began firing off, trying to sell this weaponized air tractor that he loves. And again, you know, he's not just walking a fine line, he's jumping over both sides of it and insisting that, you know, there's no legal connection between his provision of skills, military equipment, and basically warfighting expertise is related to him, and yet he brags about it. The best example of this is a documentary called The Project, which was done by Adam Ciralsky, in which Eric very proudly talks about his mercenary army in Somalia, and yet, in violation of the UN arms embargo, insists to the UN that he's got nothing to do with it other than that he's the idea guy. So I'll let people judge from the obvious, but like I say, he has a lot of lawyers that spend a lot of time keeping him out of jail.
But what's the role then of Admiral Fallon in Frontier Services Group?
Well, there was an original idea. Greg Smith is a former Marine, an investment banker. Admiral Fallon was a very well-known person in the counterterrorism area. And then, of course, Peter Phillips, who was a JSOC commander, very, very well-respected, very well-known person. They were pitching the idea of this logistics system in Africa, also supporting the AFRICOM anti-terrorism activities. And as you probably can guess, you know, transportation, logistics, as we know from that recent shootout in North Africa, is very problematic. So Eric has a solution for everything because he's a guy that looks for gaps, you know, and sometimes these are very smart ideas, and sometimes these ideas seem insane, like his Afghanistan idea. But that was the goal. So these three gentlemen found out that they had probably violated ITAR by constantly trying to sell these air tractors to South Sudan, Azerbaijan, Mali, Europe, Libya, you name it. And so they all resigned. They all resigned on the same day. And if you read the articles, the FSG board, which has two CITIC members, wanted Blackwater. And that's the terminology they used in that meeting. So you can draw your conclusions from that.
And ITAR is the State Department's rule on international...
The Department of Justice prevents American citizens from selling weapons or services or training to foreign countries without permission. So if you want to sell, you know, hand grenades to Mexico, you have to get permission from the International Treaty on Arms Ratification, I think.
Mm-hmm. So, but I brought up Admiral Fallon because it looks like Prince is using American military brass as a kind of decoration to give it legitimacy, but they're essentially working for a country, China, that is not an American ally, to say the least.
Well, you got to remember that Eric has always hired people who had expertise in certain areas, and then he would market or rent those people to clients who needed that expertise. If you were to look at Frontier Services Group in its initial configuration, which was essentially a logistics and frontier investment company, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, if you can get copper to market, or if you can create better transportation or healthcare or whatever, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But this military aspect was troubling because you're sitting around the boardroom with members of the Chinese Communist Party's sovereign wealth fund. It's kind of evocative of his one beer meeting in the Seychelles with the head of RDIF. So
that's the thing that Mueller is looking into, right?
Yes, and many other things.
Right.
So my point is this. Eric starts off with an idea. It doesn't seem that bad of an idea. And then it starts to slide into this sort of reoccurring mercenary army concept that he keeps bringing up and pitching. And then those people get very nervous. And, you know, friends of mine were pilots for his in South Sudan, and they didn't sign on to fight a war. You know, they were there to supply a refinery. And suddenly they find themselves in the middle of a civil war trying to impress Salva Kiir, the president, by bringing in weapons and ammunition and bringing out wounded soldiers. So you can see how these shift very rapidly into this militarized view of how Eric sees the world.
But the latest venture that he's involved in through Frontier Services Group is apparently, and he mentioned it, in Africa and also in the Congo, but also in Afghanistan. And they're basically going to try and bring security and buy into mining operations to get cobalt and other minerals that are needed for high tech. And the main customer from all of these minerals is China.
Yes, and also Israel and also America. But I think what's hidden behind this idea, and Eric tried this in 2012 with Christophe Chalier of RENCAP, where they wanted to corner the entire niobium tantalum market, which is what you really want. In other words, that's niobium is the thing that makes lithium batteries work better, and it's a very rare mineral, and it's easy to transport, but it's found in very contentious places like DRC, Equatorial Guinea, and Rwanda. If you can get into these places and not get shot or have the local warlord raid your camp, you can then mine it, bring it out, sell it at a premium. So his idea on paper makes perfect sense. Why not, you know, capture strategic minerals, as they're called, and, you know, make money? But these are in war zones, and people tend to shoot at you in war zones. And Eric tends to hire people who know how to shoot back. And whether it's South African mercenaries or whether it's, you know, Australian pilots or whatever, this is what you see his business plans doing, is veering towards the sort of East India Company version of business, where you make strange deals with powerful potentates and dictators, and suddenly you're in a shooting war.
Well, but he's denying involvement with the Chinese, even though his company built the main training at Beijing's International Security Defense College. And that was all revealed in a Washington Post piece back in May of 2018.
It was also revealed by Eric, who literally did interviews bragging about the logistics system that they're building. So he's realized that he's crossed the line, that he has to deny it or else he's going to be in trouble with the Department of Justice.
But my understanding is, and this testimony came out, a U.S. Marine was working for Prince, gave sworn testimony in the federal court in Virginia, saying that Prince views himself as a Christian crusader tasked with eliminating Muslims and the Islamic faith from the globe. So if that's his mindset, then it's not surprising that he's helping the Chinese repress the Uyghurs.
Well, I would kind of scrape off the more lurid descriptions of what Prince does. Prince needs money. You know, he's in it for the money. He's not a billionaire. He's like Donald Trump. He's hustling from one deal to the next. And the Chinese are willing to spend a lot of money for basically frangible or disposable security services. Now, you can imagine that if you've got a mine in Afghanistan and you've got to somehow bring that all the way across Afghanistan through Pakistan, through, you know, the western part of China into some, you know, smelting area, people are going to try to stop you. So they understand very easily that this is going to require Western quality security and defense. The question is how close does Eric stay to this before he gets into trouble again, just like he did with our government, and that's why he had to pay $42 million to get out of that.
Well, Robert Young Pilton, I thank you for joining us, and I just would remind our audience, of course, that Eric Prince's sister, Betsy DeVos, is the Secretary of Education, and even though he may not be a billionaire, they both come from a very wealthy family. Right. So let's stay tuned, and thanks again for joining us, Robert Young Pilton.
Always my pleasure, Ian. Thanks.
And thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Robert Young Pilton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has had a first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. And his books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, License to Kill, Hired Guns, and the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the leaked memo that shows that President Trump has an extraordinary amount of executive time, meaning he watches television and calls his friends for most of the day.
He fastened all the triggers for the others to fire. And then you sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion while the young people's blood flows out of their bodies and is buried in the mud.
Yeah.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Alan Linkman, an American political historian who teaches at American University and has studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, a surefire way to predicting the next president. His prediction systems have correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984, including the last election when, against all odds, he predicted a Trump victory. He's the author of the national bestseller, The Case for Impeachment, and his latest book is The Embattled Vote in America, From the Founding to the Present. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Linkman.
Thank you so much.
Well, on the day of the State of the Union, Alan, and we're literally an hour from now, or less than an hour from now, we'll be hearing from the president, of course, a delayed State of the Union, and unusual for him to have behind him his new nemesis, Nancy Pelosi, who he just said the other day is bad for America. And, of course, apparently this speech is going to include some olive branches and a call for bipartisanship, which is certainly a little odd given Trump's recent statements. But Axios received a leak from obviously a very, very high-ranking White House insider a couple of days ago of the president's schedule. And we know that he watches a lot of television, but now it's there in writing, the extent to which he watches 6 hours or more of television per day. I've often said that this is a bizarre situation. It would be like an actor being only interested in the reviews, not the performance, because he spends so little time actually governing, so much time watching for the reviews of his presidency. So in an historical perspective, how odd is this?
It's really odd. Let me say this. You know, anyone who gets their information from Fox News gets what they deserve. Look, I'm not against unstructured time. In fact, I think there can be some benefits from that. George Reedy, in his great book, The Twilight of the Presidency, talked about how the president gets caught in this groupthink bubble where the president is surrounded by these yes people who simply verify and validate everything the president says and does. And so unstructured alone time can be valuable if you use it to think, to learn, to deepen your knowledge of history and current affairs. Unfortunately, that seems to be the exact opposite of what Donald Trump is doing. Donald Trump has blown away this invaluable executive time. He has shown no curiosity about history, politics, religion, morality, or anything else that might matter to a president. Instead, he seems, as you say, to care only about the reviews, only about the adulation from favorable news outlets or his base. That's a disaster for a president. And, you know, other recent presidents had vastly more structured time, worked much harder than Donald Trump. George W. Bush would get up very, very early. Some say he'd be in the office before 7 a.m. Barack Obama would come in a little bit later because he took exercise in the morning, but was known sometimes to stay and work till 1 or 2 a.m. in the morning. FDR, Franklin, the great Franklin Roosevelt, despite his disability, was an extremely hard worker in the White House. And so President Trump seems to have none of the virtues of past presidents. He hasn't used executive time to deepen and expand his knowledge, and he hasn't been working in a structured way like other recent presidents.
Well, when you talk about sycophants, surrounded by sycophants, it seems that Trump has his sycophants, particularly his spokesperson, Sarah Sanders, has also adopted Trump's hyperbole and self-congratulations. In response to the Axios story, Sarah Sanders says, President Trump has a different leadership style than his predecessors, and the results speak for themselves. He spends much more of his average day in scheduled meetings, events, and calls to allow for a more creative environment that has helped make him the most productive president in modern history. I mean, these people are,
you know,
amazing.
If I didn't laugh at that, I'd cry.
Right, right.
And the now hyperbole is just teeth jarring. You know, that they've had some polls of, you know, independent experts in history and politics, and typically they rank Donald Trump as the worst American president. You know, this notion that he's accomplished more than any other president. Well, in his first 100 days, Franklin Delano Roosevelt got 15 major pieces of legislation through Congress. And over 2 years, Donald Trump has gotten one major piece of legislation through Congress, and that is the big tax cuts for the rich. Yes, he's done a lot with executive orders, and some of them are probably beneficial, but what he's done with executive orders is ravaged the environment and exposed us to potentially catastrophic effects of climate change by destroying all of the protections that had previously built in under the Environmental Protection Agency, by throttling down any efforts to make the transition from fossil fuels to clean and renewable sources of energy, and indeed to promoting the very fossil fuels that are causing this horrific climate change. So, yeah, you can deregulate, but that doesn't mean it's a plus in the long run. That could be the greatest crime that Donald Trump has committed, a crime against humanity, because he is putting us all at risk.
And again, I'm speaking with Alan Lichtman, who is an American political historian who teaches at American University and has studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President, a prediction system that's correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984, including the last election when, against all odds, he predicted a Trump victory. He's the author of the national bestseller, The Case for Impeachment, and his latest book is The Embattled Vote in America, From the Founding to the Present. Now, JFK, Jack Kennedy, he apparently would take a two-hour nap during the day, usually after swimming in the White House pool with Fiddle and Faddle, the two beautiful ladies on the National Security Council. So we probably know why he needed a nap.
But he needed a lot of naps in his activities and his bad health. I don't know how he kept it up.
Right, right. Well, I think LBJ also took a midday nap. But they still worked pretty long hours, didn't they?
They worked really long hours. And certainly for JFK, he was a reader and a thinker. And, you know, I can't stress how important that is for a president of the United States. And LBJ was less of a reader, less of a thinker, perhaps. But he, as we know, was the great master of the legislative process. You know, Donald Trump talks a game as a negotiator, but he may be the lamest negotiator we've ever seen in the White House. LBJ was a master. And in terms of accomplishments, you would say that Donald Trump's are a molehill compared to what Lyndon Johnson did. After all, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, Medicare, Medicaid, aid to education, important environmental legislation. You can go on and on. Only in the eyes of Sarah Sanders or Donald Trump could he conceivably compare to some of these accomplished presidents of the past. Let me say another point. You talked about Donald Trump being surrounded by sycophants, and that is certainly true. You know, everything Donald Trump touches turns to gold. And whenever there's a new indictment or guilty plea, even when it's the president's own inaugural committee or the chair of his campaign or his lawyer, it has nothing to do with the president, right? That would be, you know, just totally laughable if it wasn't so sad. But he isn't totally surrounded by sycophants. You know, he's been railing against leaks throughout his presidency. But who are these leaks coming from? People that he himself picked to be in the White House. So somehow being in the White House seems to be a very disillusioning experience. Not only does everybody or great numbers leave, but there's been, you know, these extraordinary leaks as well.
Well, that's all been verified, has it not, in this new book by White House aide Cliff Sims. The book's called A Team of Vipers, which pretty much tells it all. clearly this person who leaked this daily schedule has to be among the top aides to have access to that kind of very, very private piece of paper. So what does that say, though, about those people around Trump? You keep hearing from reporters and leakers that this is a man that's out of control. He's infantile. He's given to tantrums. He doesn't listen to anybody, least of all his intelligence briefers. And he's mercurial and likely to explode at any moment. He treats his subordinates really badly. And little wonder they leak. But that's my takeaway, Alan Lichtman, is that we need to be able to see this man for who he is. And they sort of constructed a wall to protect us from the reality, and we get these little leaks through the edges painting a portrait of a very disturbed and disturbing man.
Absolutely. And, you know, all of those things you outline are correct. You know, Trump came in and said, I'm going to appoint the best people. Well, he seems to have appointed the best criminals, the best conspirators, the best liars you could possibly put together, and the really good people like H.R. McMaster or General Mattis, they fled this White House. But I think it goes even deeper. I always get a little bit disturbed when I hear people emphasizing too much the chaos, the disorder, you know, he's new, he doesn't know. All that's true, and all that is tremendously disturbing. But what is far worse is this man's utterly warped sense of values and morality. Even if he was the most organized and disciplined person in the world, because of his terrible values and his immorality, he would still be an awful president. He would still be intent on destroying the environment. He would still be intent on rewarding his rich friends at the expense of everybody else. He still would be intent on corrupting the government in order to pad his own pockets and surrounding himself with people doing the same thing. It's not just chaos. It is at its core a deeply immoral, flawed individual who, even if he was as organized as Barack Obama, would still be a disaster in the White House.
Well, when you mentioned the adults that have fled, like General Mattis and McMaster, my understanding is that there's only sycophants and lightweights around him now. You've got the most sycophantic of all the sycophants, Vice President Mike Pence. You've got his chief of staff.
I can't stand looking at that grin anymore.
But the chief of staff, or acting chief of staff, they're calling Mulvaney, he apparently has no authority, and Trump ignores him. And then he's got his closest aides. You know, he listens to Corey Lewandowski, this David Bossie, the guy responsible for the Citizens United hit, Matt Slapp, and then Stephen Miller, and then Ivanka and Jared. And Jared more and more seems to be his number one advisor. And apparently Trump and Jared met with a bunch of contractors who to build the wall. So stay tuned for the State of the Union.
Yeah, you know, he has money to build a wall, and he's lied about it. He says, we've built, you know, a good bit of wall. He hasn't built an inch of wall. What has been done is some repair on existing wall. But even though he's had money to expand the wall, you know, dozens of miles, he hasn't done anything with the money because he doesn't know how to make anything happen. That's not a problem. You know, he doesn't build things. What Donald Trump does is lend his name to projects. It's been a very long time since he tried to build anything on his own. And often when he's tried to do that, it's been a colossal failure.
So what do you just in the last couple of minutes, Alan Lichtman, what do you expect from the upcoming State of the Union?
Oh, the State of the Union is better than it's ever been. I've made America great again. I'm the greatest president you've ever seen. I've accomplished more than anyone else. What I've done is great for the country. Look at this booming economy. I've made us safe from Russia and North Korea and what have you. And, of course, I am willing to work across the aisle and reach out to the Democrats in the interests of the country. And, of course, he has probably raised the prospects of a national emergency to build the so-called wall, which is, in a sense, terrible precedent, as even Mitch McConnell recognizes to declare an emergency for a political goal. But it just postpones everything. You know, it's going to be caught in the courts for a year, and if he even wins in the court, then it's going to be caught another year in eminent domain with the landowners. So it's just a way of him saying, I've won, and as always, nothing will happen.
Well, it's not just that Mitch McConnell that's alarmed at the possibility of declaring a national emergency and then raiding Pentagon funds to build the wall, and presumably he's going to dragoon the military into being contractors. But it's the number two guy on the Republican Senate, Senator Cornyn, who came out against it. And he basically described what you just described, where this thing would head into the courts and what a terrible precedent it would be. So to my mind,
they're worried, you know, a Democratic president will declare a national emergency on something real like climate change.
Right. But, you know, this situation could be really the key to what's going to happen tonight, isn't it?
Whether
he's going to.
That's the shadow hanging over this. He can brag all he wants about everything else, but this is what people want to hear about.
Right, right. And his base apparently want him to do it. And even Jared apparently is arguing against it. But it could go either way, I guess.
I guess. I do think there's a fair chance. He can't shut down the government again. Right. That would be just too much of a political disaster. So either they've got to reach some agreement, which I think is possible. So, you know, he doesn't care about the substance of this. You got to understand that when it comes to Trump. He only cares about Trump. He doesn't care about the border. He doesn't care about border security. The only thing he cares about is, I want to be able to portray this as a win. And I don't care what the substance of that win might be or how it affects the country.
Well, I don't know whether the Democrats have made the case, but it is truly the stupidest thing in the world for any government, let alone this government with so many challenges, to waste money on a wall. And it's a monument to this man's ego. And all presidents and all politicians make ridiculous promises on the campaign trail, but most of them have the sense to sort of pretend they didn't say it. This guy keeps going back to that same poisoned well.
Yeah, how well did it work for him in the midterm elections of 2018? Not real well. That's how he got his, maybe not his ultimate nemesis, but certainly a nemesis in Nancy Pelosi, his worst nightmare, an uppity woman that he can't control and that can best him. The only thing that would have been worse for him would be if Nancy Pelosi had also been African-American.
And she'll be looking over his shoulder tonight. So I thank you, Alan Lichtman.
Absolutely.
I thank you for joining
us. My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Alan Lichtman, an American political historian who teaches at American University and has studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President. And his prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984, including the last election when, against all odds, he predicted a Trump victory. He's the author of the national bestseller, The Case for Impeachment, and his latest book is The Embattled Vote in America, From the Founding to the Present. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back speaking with a presidential historian on the history of contentious relationships between House speakers hosting presidents at the State of the Union. You can't. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, whose books include The Fierce Urgency of Now, The Presidency of Barack Obama, A First Historical Assessment. And his latest book, co-authored with Kevin Cruz, is Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974. And he's the co-host of the Politics and Polls podcast. And he has an article at CNN, State of the Union will kick off an epic fight between Trump and Pelosi. Welcome to Background Briefing, Julian Zelizer.
Thanks for having me.
And a little more than 15 minutes from now, Julian, the State of the Union will kick off. And there is already a memo from the White House suggesting the theme of his address will be choosing greatness, and that the president will appeal to American aspirations. And there's also been talk that it will be a sort of bipartisan olive branch. And of course, he will have Nancy Pelosi standing behind him. What do you expect?
Well, I expect that might be very well the theme he chooses to emphasize tonight. He might call the nation to come together. He might call the nation to achieve its best. But just because he says it, and just because he says it in the State of the Union, doesn't mean it reflects who he is. The right up through today, he has been continuing with the same kind of very divisive rhetoric that he's used his entire presidency. It's not going to change when this is over. So with President Trump, I don't think we can, take whatever he says at too much value, because I think his record is pretty clear, both in terms of playing to partisan division and also to playing to fear rather than the greatness of the nation.
So do you expect the Democrats, with a new majority in the House, and also all of those presidential candidates that have either announced or expected to announce, will they sit stone-faced?
That's always interesting to watch, including obviously Speaker Pelosi, who's right behind him. I assume they will. He might say something that makes it awkward for them to do so. So there might be a few moments where they clap at a statement. But generally, I don't think there'll be a lot of movement. It will be a visual replay of the battle over the government shutdown, where the Democrats make quite clear just through their physicality what they think about what the president is doing. And they're not going to play into the idea that a few kind words reflect some big shift in the presidency.
Well, apparently he's going to make an announcement about a plan to stop the transmission of HIV/AIDS by 2030, and also touch on abortion, and perhaps also talk about a legislative solution to the so-called Dreamers. So obviously, abortion is throwing a bone to the religious right, so we know who'll get up and cheer in that regard. What about the HIV issue and a legislative solution to the Dreamers?
Well, yeah, I mean, again, Democrats are going to be sympathetic to both of those goals and very much would like to achieve legislation that addresses both the Dreamers and continued efforts to prevent AIDS and to cure it even in better fashion. But there's not a lot of trust in that room. Many of the Democrats have very little sense or faith that just because the president says that, he's going to move forward with it in the next few weeks. And so, again, they will give ceremonial applause when necessary. They're not going to refuse to clap in favor of restoring the rights of the Dreamers. But it's going to be very hesitant at best. There's just no goodwill in this room. And more than any time I can remember in recent presidential history, there is no trust or faith that what he says is what he's going to do starting tomorrow.
Well, just a few days ago, the president, in essence, questioned Nancy Pelosi's patriotism. He said that she was bad for America. And she also recently, on January the 25th, sent out a tweet asking rhetorically, what does Putin have on Trump, either personally, politically, or financially? That's an amazing statement, don't you think, coming from any politician, let alone the Speaker of the House?
It really is. And obviously that statement comes in the context of the investigations, which are accelerating as of today, as of the day he gives the State of the Union, not just the Mueller investigation, but in New York, the Southern District. A lot of news has broken in the last few days about what they're looking at, including the Inauguration Committee. So for the speaker to say that, to say it in a pointed way, and to say it in the context of this investigation, that's a kind of division and distrust from the speaker to the president that hasn't existed. It's not simply a debate over issues. It's not simply a debate over strategy. It's really questioning where the loyalty of her adversary is.
And again, I'm speaking with Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, whose books include The Fierce Urgency of Now, The Presidency of Barack Obama, A First Historical Assessment. And his latest book, co-authored with Kevin Cruz, is Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974. And he's the co-host of the Politics and Polls podcast, and he has an article at CNN, State of the Union Will Kick Off an Epic Fight Between Trump and Pelosi. Let's talk a bit about your article in terms of some of the historical examples you give of very, very polarized political moments, and also put this particularly political moment in an historic perspective, because many see our current condition as perhaps the most polarized it's ever been.
Sure, there's several moments where you'll have a speaker sitting behind a president during these messages of different parties and who are really at odds with each other. So one example that I start with is in 1974 when Richard Nixon makes his final State of the Union address, and he actually calls on the nation to move beyond the whole Watergate investigation, saying it should just be done. And Carl Albert, who's the Speaker of the House, a Democrat from Oklahoma, is sitting behind him and understands that despite what President Nixon is saying, everything is going to ratchet up. The House Judiciary Committee was getting ready to begin the impeachment process. And there you had, again, tension not just over issues, but tensions over the fate of the presidency. And that will very much be what's going on in the minds of the Democrats and Speaker Pelosi during this address. Fast forward to the 1980s. In 1983, you have Speaker Tip O'Neill, who's a Democrat, sitting behind Ronald Reagan. And there, O'Neill wasn't thinking about the future of Reagan's presidency. There was no scandal comparable to Watergate or what we have today. But there were fundamental issues over the direction of public policy in this country, over issues like Social Security and the Cold War. And I think some of the tensions between Tip O'Neill and Reagan will also be part of what you watch when you see this State of the Union address. So they're both going to be at play in one moment as President Trump gives his address.
Well, you mentioned Nixon's last State of the Union. 6 months after he gave that address, facing impeachment, he resigned. So is there a possible analogy there? I mean, you've got the Mueller report coming out now. There's talk of it coming out within a month. So do you think that could possibly be a situation now where you'll have a president giving a State of the Union and in a matter of months, people will be calling for his impeachment?
Well, you know, everything is possible. And what is important when you look back just at the photo or watch the video of President Nixon in 1974 giving his State of the Union address, what ended up happening was not at all evident that that was how it was going to unfold. The idea he would resign by that summer was not on the minds of most Americans, nor was it clear an impeachment process would really get going. And so that's what we have to remember about scandals. They unfold in real time. What we know about the outcome is not evident as this happens. And so that's why, in some ways, the visuals tonight and the interaction tonight isn't that different than in January 1974. You couldn't see where this was going. You couldn't imagine the impeachment process would begin or that Nixon would resign. So nothing is off the table. And I do believe the accusations, the cumulative accusations that President Trump is facing from the Mueller report to the campaign finance violations are as serious as what was going on in 74. So we shouldn't discount the possibility this presidency might not be completed.
But on the other hand, the speakers standing behind the president, they've also suffered scandal and been forced to resign. Speaker Jim Wright standing behind Reagan in January of 1987. And then, of course, you point out in your article, you couldn't miss the glee on the face of the new Republican Speaker Newt Gingrich looking down on President Clinton in 1995. And, of course, he had to step down in 1999. So that, I guess that's what happens in Washington, right? It's one scandal versus another.
Well, that's true. And sometimes when you open the door to focusing on these kinds of issues, obviously the parties will do everything possible to preserve their power. They will unleash everything they know against their adversaries. The politics ain't beanbag, as the saying goes. And so that's not something that Democrats won't be thinking about. That's how the dynamic unfolds. There's nothing to do about that. And the history, again, of when the House members go down or whether Senate members go down, it's all very unpredictable. But nothing at this point, I think, is equal to what the president is facing in terms of the risk to his future politically. So there's nothing, for example, that Speaker Pelosi is dealing with in terms of any kind of scandal that's anything like what the administration faces.
But this speech itself has been postponed because the Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, didn't want to have Trump visit her house as long as the government was shut down. And he had to relent. And I can't see him doing another government shutdown. Can you?
Well, I could imagine him doing another government shutdown, but I can't imagine the Senate Republicans going along with it, and maybe not even the House Republicans. I think the cost of the last month was immense, and Speaker Pelosi showed the basic fact of Washington. She has the votes to stop this right now, and the Democrats are disciplined. So I think even if the president considered doing this all over again, he would hear from Republicans who might even threaten to vote for a spending bill with Democrats to essentially prevent any kind of veto. So it is hard to imagine them replicating it. That said, in the last 2 years, we've seen many things we all thought couldn't happen or wouldn't happen, and then they did, just because he doesn't follow conventional rules, and he's often willing to ignore the conventional wisdom of politics. But it would be a hard thing for him to do politically to try to do this again, where the outcome would probably be exactly the same.
So does that mean that his only option is to declare a national emergency?
Well, that is one option, and he's getting pushback from Senator McConnell and some other Republicans who are warning they might not support him. But it is an option that will be attractive to him, even if he might lose in that battle, because he can move forward. He can get out of this particular fight he's been in with Democrats and fight another day for the wall through emergency power. The other option is to not move forward with it and either to rename the Homeland Security funding he does get as some kind of wall, or just to say the Democrats obstructed this and right now there's nothing to do. But the one option that is very hard to see is him forcing it through the Democratic House.
So do you think he'll bring it up tonight?
I do think he'll bring it up. And if you follow his Twitter, he has not stopped talking about this in the last 24 hours. So it's very much on his mind. And I think at some level, he will bring it up tonight. He does not want to let this go yet, at least as an issue.
And what do you think the atmospherics will be in terms of coverage of the gallery? Because, you know, you've got pretty deliberate choice of guests. He's chosen a young boy who apparently was bullied, whose name is Trump. Perhaps Melania chose him. But on the Democratic side, Nancy Pelosi apparently has chosen to have members of the military who are transgender. And, of course, that's a rebuke of Trump's recent ban on transgender troops. And then a number of people, I believe, who have worked for Trump at his various properties who are undocumented. So what do you expect in terms of how the gallery will be featured?
Yeah, so the guests have always been part of the gallery, and since 1982. This is when Reagan invites the first guest, and increasingly they've become something of a political prop. They are there to make a statement for one of the two parties. This, as with everything in the Trump presidency, is being done on a grandiose scale. The Democrats have guests, which will be a reminder to everyone who is watching and everyone who's covering this, of all those policy areas that the administration has pursued, which really go against fundamental values that the Democrats stand for and that they'll be promoting in 2020. And I think they have not been subtle in the persons who will be in the room tonight to watch the president speak. The president, of course, makes a Trumpian choice to focus on bullying when this is something he's been criticized about. And of course, the story he wants to tell is in part about himself by choosing a child whose last name is Trump. It couldn't be more fitting in terms of how he tries to make a point. But I think the Democrats in this case are probably putting together, from what I've heard, a more powerful message through their guests to just, again, remind the country that this isn't just a debate over scandal and corruption. It's also a debate that's unfolding over fundamental issues and what the nation stands for.
Well, just in closing, Julian Zeller, let's talk a little bit about the rebuttal from Stacey Abrams, who ran for governor in Georgia and was narrowly defeated, and it was very highly contested. And she doesn't hold office at the moment. I don't think I remember any rebuttal, whether it was from a Democrat or a Republic, being particularly powerful or certainly overshadowing the State of the Union. So what do you expect from Stacey Abrams?
Yeah, it's funny. There's often a lot of excitement about the rebuttal, and almost always they don't come across very well. Person usually looks awkward. Visually, it never works very well. And somehow, they never look as grand as the president. And so that's always the fear. She's a very promising new voice in the Democratic Party. Some are encouraging her to run for the Senate in Georgia. And I think a lot of Democrats, as excited as they are about having her as the respondent to the president, are just worried about the long history of mistakes that have been made or careers that have been killed simply by giving this response and drinking water the wrong way or coming across as stiff. I don't know. I mean, I think she's a very exciting Democrat in many ways and represents at many levels exactly where the party wants to go and is dealing with a core issue of race relations that President Trump and the Republicans have really been attacked on, including voting rights restrictions. But it's hard to forget the long list of responses that have gone badly.
Well, Julian Zeller, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And as we go into the very thing we're talking about, the State of the Union, and again, I've been speaking with Julian Zeller, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, whose books include The Fierce Urgency of Now, The Presidency of Barack Obama, A First Historical Assessment, and his latest book, co-authored with Kevin Kruse, is Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974. And he's a co-host of the Politics and Polls podcast, and he has an article at CNN, State of the Union Will Kick Off an Epic Fight Between Trump and Pelosi. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Evan Green. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now. The side of the pickup truck.
fire.